Parsha of Tetzaveh is dominated in a sense by the Bigdei Kehuna. Of course, Truma is the Mishkan and its Kelim. Tetzaveh are the special garments for the Kohen and the Kohen Gadol. But before the Parsha turns to the Bigdei Kehuna, there is a short section which is really comprised of the first two psukim, which deal with the menorah. Vatot etzaves b'nei Yisrael, v'yikui lecha Hashem en zayezach, they should take the pure oil, lahalos ner tamid. And pasuk kaf, therefore, commands that the oil be brought to Moshe. Now, why does the oil need to be brought to Moshe? And Moshe is not going to be the one who will be doing the lighting. That will be Aaron, as the next pasuk says. Nonetheless, the first stop is to Moshe. And the Ramban explains that the oil is first brought to Moshe in order to authorize it, in order to give it a hechsher, make sure that it's completely pure and completely up to par, and then it is handed on to Aaron. That's Moshe's role in the lighting of the menorah. He gives the shtempel to the oil for the lighting. Pasuk Kaf Aleph describes the location of the lighting itself. Ba'oel moed michutz laparoches asher la'edus. So in the Mishkan, just outside the paroches, yarocho so Aaron uvanov me'erav adboka lefnei Hashem. Chukas olam ledorosam. This is a lasting statute, everlasting mitzvah. And Mefarshim raised the question, of all the mitzvahs that are mentioned in last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha, we do not find these concluding words of Chukas Olam Nederosam, that they are an everlasting and a permanent fixture in the Mishkan or in the Mikdash. Presumably, whatever is stated there is permanent. What is unusual, therefore, or unique about this mitzvah that we perhaps may have thought that it is not Chukas Olam, that it is not permanent, that we need to be assured by the Torah that it is indeed Chukas Olam Ludorosam. And there are a couple of classic responses to this question. The Ramban, in his Perush on the Torah, explains that perhaps of all of the aspect of the avodah and the mitzvahs in the Mishkan, one may have thought that the menorah is not permanent. Why ever not? Because, says Ramban, one may have thought that perhaps the menorah is only for the Mishkan, for one of the primary differences between the Mishkan and the Mikdash, although there were many, is that the Beis HaMikdash has windows, as we read in the Haftorah, Chalonos, Shkufim, Hatumim, and therefore there is a possibility of light from the outside. The Mishkan, on the other hand, is entirely closed, and therefore one may have thought that the aspect of the Mishkan which provides light only necessary for Mishkan where there is no other source of light. But perhaps as we move to the Beis HaMikdash, it will no longer be necessary. That's what one may have thought. To that end, the Torah emphasizes and reassures us, Chukas Olam Ledorosam, this mitzvah, like the other mitzvahs, is for all time. Now, this explanation of the Ramban is very interesting and caught the attention of the Maharsham in his commentary on the Ramban Tehillas Mordechai. He raises a simple question. What is the Ramban saying? One may have thought that in the Mishkan, it's all closed, there's no light, that's when you need a menorah. In the Beis HaMikdash, there are windows. Says Maharsham, indeed there are. Except, at what stage of the day is the menorah meant to be lit? The menorah is lit, me'erev ad boker. It's just as the day is coming to a close, and then essentially it lights through the night. Says Maharsham, if it's nighttime, it doesn't make a difference if the house has windows. I mean, outside it's dark. And therefore, given the time frame of the mitzvah of lighting menorah, why would I think that it makes a difference that in the Beis HaMikdash, it's true, if you wait till daytime, then there will be light. But that's not when the mitzvah of the menorah is. Why then should it make a difference? Night, a house with windows or without windows is exactly the same. I'm sure there's a Yiddish saying that says approximately that somewhere. And that is why the Marsham suggests that perhaps we see here in these words of the Ramban an ally for the position of the Rambam with regards to the mitzvah of Ner Menorah. For whereas, according to most authorities, most Rishonim, the mitzvah of lighting the menorah is only at night. It's done at the end of the day, Bein Ha'arbayim, what's called. It lights through the night, and in the morning, that's that. The only thing that happens in the morning is what's known as Hatovas Haneros, that the lamps are cleaned out and new wicks are prepared, but nothing else will happen. There'll be no more lighting until the end of the next day. That is the opinion of most Rishonim. However, Rambam, for various reasons, is of the opinion that actually in the morning, alongside or accompanying the Hatovas Haner is another lighting. According to the Rambam, the menorah is lit twice every 24 hours, at the onset of night and the beginning of the morning. As says the Treles Mordechai, it seems that the Ramban is in agreement with Rambam, that there are two lightings. And that is, whereas for the lighting of the night, perhaps one may have thought that it should continue because there is no light, being that it's dark outside. But at least with respect to the lighting of the morning, where it is light outside, that's when the Ramban makes his comment that perhaps this lighting is no longer necessary. They can rely on light from coming in through the windows. To that end, the Torah says, Chukas Olam L'Darosam. So that's a very interesting comment of the Marsham. Almost through, indirectly, we glean perhaps an ally for the Rambam in the Ramban through this comment. Having said that, there is another possibility with regards to understanding why the Torah needed to say Chukas Olam L'Darosam. Again, to be clear, our question is, it's a mitzvah like other mitzvahs, why would I think it would be at any time discontinued that I need to be assured otherwise? Well, certain Meforshim draw our attention or remind us that the mitzvah began by Moshe being told that the oil has to come to him first. That's the mitzvah. It's not said about other things, but it's said about the oil for the lighting. So what if you don't have Moshe Rabbeinu to check the oil? One may have thought that with the absence of Moshe, if he's so much a part of the mitzvah as it's originally presented, then perhaps absent Moshe, perhaps there is no mitzvah. And thus the Torah says, even if Moshe is not there, nonetheless the mitzvah itself will continue. That's a second approach. And what's interesting is, there is a Medrash commenting on the fact that Moshe has to check the oil and okay it. Mikan sheyehei chosamcha alav, you need to give it the seal of approval. Your seal, o chosamo shel kohen gadol, or the seal of the kohen gadol. In other words, according to the Medrash, actually, in principle, the requirement that someone like Moshe check the oil and approve it is always true. Now, it's not always going to be Moshe, but it's going to be someone in lieu of Moshe, and that will be, of course, the Kohen Gadol. Which means, according to the Medrash, Chukas Olam L'Darosam is telling us that, in fact, every aspect of the mitzvah will continue permanently. Not only the lighting, of course, but also the checking and the approving. That's also permanent. Initially, it's with Moshe, but after Moshe, it's the Kohen Gadol. And in fact, Rav Kasher, in the Torah Shlema, notes that this is the source in Halacha for something that we take for granted. Anyone who knows the Hanukkah story, so they searched far and wide for the oil, and they didn't find until the one flask that had the seal of the Kohen Gadol. And Mefarshim asked the question, we never heard of this idea, the seal of a Kohen Gadol. Why does he have to, where does that come from? If it's pure, it's pure. But this notion of formally approving and having a seal, but according to the way the Medrash is explained in the Pasuk, that is part of the mitzvah from that someone needs to approve the oil. Initially Moshe, subsequently Kohen Gadol, and that's the flask that they found which you needed with the Chosam of Shel Kohen Gadol. So we're never far away from Chanukah, especially when we're talking about the mitzvah of the menorah, and to see from through these words the source and the roots for that which will become such an important part of that story. So moving forwards to the Big Day Kahuna, and there's many, many psukim, and there's details. And we begin with the most basic of questions. Why do the Kohanim, and especially the Kohen Gadol, why do they need to have these clothes? They have certain things that they need to do, but why do they need to be wearing specific garments as they do them? And this is a question which is addressed, of course, by the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch is always looking to provide an understanding of all the mitzvahs, and therefore, as he discusses the mitzvah of Big Day Kahuna, he explains what he calls Mishar Sheha Mitzvah, some form of reason for the mitzvah, as follows. And his reason is twofold, or perhaps two-pronged, as we will see. We'll read just a few lines from the Sefer HaChinuch. Mishar Sheha Mitzvah, what's the mitzvah about? Hayesod HaKavua Lanu. There is a well-established principle by us, says Sefer HaChinuch. He's mentioned it a number of times. Ki ha'adam nif'al lefi pu'ulosso. A person's mood, frame of mind, state of mind is affected by the things that he do, by physical actions and objects. They make a difference to the person. That's important. Not only the kind people do acts of kindness, acts of kindness do kind people. It has that reciprocal effect. It's not only a function of a person, it can also contribute and develop the person. Therefore, Vashaliach HaMechaper, the emissary who is affecting atonement, namely the Kohen, Tzarich Latpis Kol Machshavto V'Kavanoso El HaAvodah. He has to devote and attach all of his focus and all of his intent to the avoda. His mind has to stay on the job to be and appreciate the significance of what he's doing. Al kein, ra'uy l'vosh begodim miyuhadim eileha. Therefore, it is appropriate for him to wear special clothing to that end, for that time. Kashi yistako kol mokom shebegufo, wherever he looks on his person, miyad yenizkar, he will remember and be reminded immediately. Umis ora belibo lifnei mihu obeyed. His heart will remember before whom he is serving. In other words, the Sefer HaChinuch says that the Kohen needs to have focus. These clothes will maintain that focus. There's no way that he can go about the avoda in an everyday type of fashion if he is not wearing everyday type of clothes. When you're wearing something special, it reminds you that you're doing something special. Presumably, this is also ultimately what is behind the idea of special clothes for Shabbos. V'chibadato mi'asos derachecha. V'chibadato teaches us that there is a mitzvah to wear special Shabbos clothes, and that reminds us that the Shabbos is special. Through that, we are honoring the Shabbos. A person doesn't act in the same way if he's wearing smart clothing than he does if he's wearing everyday clothing. And therefore, the first beneficiary, shall we say, or the first focus of the Big Day Kahuna is the Kohen himself. If he's wearing special clothing, he'll remain especially vigilant and alert. But then, says Sefer HaChinuch, moving towards the end of that paragraph, Milvad, aside from that, sheyesh ba'inyan covered labayis v'la'avoda, it also gives glory to the Beis HaMikdash and to the avoda. That is to say, people come to the Beis HaMikdash. They bring a korban. It's an important experience for them. It's meant to be an impactful experience and a memorable experience. Hopefully one that will leave its mark. Ukvachasavnu, he says in the final two lines, we have already written, ki bahagdolas habayis uvamaro'o, the grander the Beis HaMikdash, and the more awesome the experience, yisrakhu sham libus achotim, that will soften the hearts of those that have sinned, perhaps, v'yashuvu el Hashem. It's got to be an imposing experience. It has to be a special experience. And anything that can contribute to that is ultimately contributing to the positive spiritual outcome from the visit that people pay to the Beis HaMikdash. So it's very interesting. One could almost say that the big day kahuna are inwardly focused for the Kohen himself, but also outwardly focused. It should make an impression on people. It should leave an impact. And these things do. That's the Sefer HaChinuch classic explanation. It's fascinating to note that the Malbim also discusses this matter, what are Big Day Kahuna about, and adds another dimension. And he begins, as is his way, by raising a question. Pasuk Beis states, Pasuk Beis of Perek Kavches, V'osisa Big Day Kodesh, La'aron Achicha, you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, L'chavad u'l'sefaras, for honor, for glory. And the Malbim raises the question, what exactly does this Pasuk mean? What is the Pasuk telling Moshe to do? At it most straightforward, if we translate, it says that Moshe should make the garments. We know that, practically speaking, that didn't happen. Moshe doesn't need to make the garments. Perhaps it means, if we take a step back, that it means that Moshe should oversee the making of the garments. I mean, he's in charge, he's the manager. Well, that's true, but that's not sufficient. Because overseeing the project of the Big Day Kahuna is stated explicitly in the next Pasuk, Pasuk Gimel, which states, V'ata tedaber kol chachmei lev, speak to those who are wise of heart, asher milei sivru chachma, who if I fill their heart with wisdom, v'osu, and they will make as Big Day Aaron lekacho lechano li, and they will make the garments for Aaron. Which means that what we presume the first Pasuk means, namely oversee it and speak to people and delegate, is spelled out in the next Pasuk. Which means we need to go back to the first Pasuk and say, well then, what is Moshe being told to do here? V'osisa Big Day Kodesh. Rather, the Malbim explains as follows. A number of Mefarshim, famous amongst them, the Akedas Yitzhak, Reb Yitzhak Aramah, discourse and discuss the Big Day Kahuna and explain that the goal of the Big Day Kahuna is in order to develop and inspire and to instruct with regards to elevated qualities, Midos Tovos. The Gemara tells us in two places, actually, that the Big Day Kahuna, when the Kohen wears the priestly garments, that itself affects atonement for certain Averis. So Me'il is the Kapara for Lashon Hara, and Tzitz is for brazenness, and goes through all eight. But the Akedas Yitzhak explains, that doesn't mean to say that you can do Averis and the Kohen Gadol, or the Kohen will wear his garments and it will all work out. The moral of the story is not to say that if the Kohen's wardrobe is in order, then everything is in order. Rather, what it means is there's something about these garments, the way they're made, what they look like, what they consist of, etc., that are messages for people who encounter them as an antidote, or better still, a prevention for those various middos. That's what it means when it says that the Big Day Kahuna affect atonement for those Averis. There's lessons to be learned. And interestingly, the word midah, when we speak of midos, character traits, they're also garments of sorts. we find references in the Tanakh to certain qualities as garments, as being worn. It says, for example, in Yeshaya, live she owes. Wear strength. Strength is a midah, and it's worn. And in a sense, as the Mefarshim explain, the midos really qualities and characteristics and personality traits. They are the clothing of the person. They're the clothing of the soul. As surely as a person's clothing says something about him, so a person's personality traits say a great deal about him as well. I mean, he is wrapped up in them. And they can sometimes be very revealing. And midah actually is referred to, in the Chumash itself refers to midaso as a garment, but that's really what a midah is. It's also a type of a garment. And so, the goal of the Bigdei Kehuna is in order, beyond everything the Sefer HaChinuch says, in order to teach these lessons. It turns out, therefore, that there are two aspects to Bigdei Kehuna. There's the practicalities of how to make them, but then there's the innerness, there's the message, there's the theme that's embodied within these garments. And now the question is, who shall effect what? I mean, who shall bring this about? Who shall make the garments, and who shall instill the lessons? Who shall communicate the themes and the values? Says Malbim, that is the division of Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Gimel, the first and the second Pasuk. The second Pasuk is dealing with the practicalities. Speak to Chachmei Lev, they'll make the garments. That's one aspect. But the second aspect, which in fact is mentioned first, is for Moshe. It's not about weaving and spinning, but it's about instilling and educating and communicating. V'asisa bigdei kodesh la'aron achicha. You see to it that those are holy garments. L'chavad u'l'sifares. They're only going to be l'chavad u'l'sifares if the lessons are abided by, are noted and abided by. That's for you, Moshe. You don't go near the spinning wheel, but you tell them what the garments are all about. That's pasuk beis. You do that. V'asisa bigdei kodesh. And what's fascinating, and here the Malbim comes into his own, as we know, Lashon HaKodesh doesn't get better than the Malbim. For the Pasuk says, V'asisa bigdei kodesh la'aron achicha, l'chavad u'l'sifares, make the garments for kavod and tiferes. Now, kavod and tiferes, on the one hand, it's very easy to deal with them, to translate those terms. Open a thesaurus, find two words that sound similar, and attach them. So kavod tiferes could be honor and glory, or glory and splendor, and we can be oversubscribed with possibilities, but ultimately it doesn't bring us any closer to finding out what is kavod and what is tiferes, because if they're approximately the same thing, then why are they two different words? The Malbim, like the Vilna Gaon, others before and others after, do not recognize the notion of synonyms, just another way to say the same thing. Kavod has its meaning, and Tiferes has its meaning. But what are the different? What is the difference between those two terms? Well, says the Malbim, and this is in his Perush to Sefer Yeshayahu, the difference between them is that sometimes honor is due naturally to someone, person either through their lineage or yichus or whatever it may be. They may not have really done that much, but nonetheless there's something about them that commands respect. But there's another type of respect altogether, and that is someone who has worked to earn respect. The Malbim explains this is the difference between kavod and tiferes. Kavod is a respect that is naturally accrued, whereas tiferes is respect that is earned. And it's very interesting to note that, and this now moves more into the world of Rav Hirsch with his etymology, but kavod relates, of course, to the word kaved, which is heavy, which is very interesting because weight is something that just is a natural feature of the item. It doesn't need to do anything in order to have weight. It just is. It's a natural quality, and that's kind of what kavod is like. Pe'er, pe'er, which is the root of teferes, pe'er, relates to the word be'er. And be'er never happens naturally. Every well is dug. It needs to be attained and achieved and developed. And therefore, kavod and teferes are the natural weight and then the attained weight. And really, the goal is that the Kohen, through the Bigdei Kahuna, should have both. On the one hand, as we know the story goes, his father's a Kohen, his grandfather's a Kohen, he's a Kohen. So he doesn't really do anything to become a Kohen. But that's important because of his lineage, and that's called kavod. That's his natural weight. But the first pasuk says to Moshe, see to it, the Asisa Bigdei Kodesh, you have your input into the Bigdei Kahuna, so that the result will be not only kavod, but also tiferes. Let the Kohanim develop themselves. Let them take note of the clothing that they're wearing. Take the appropriate messages to heart. Act accordingly. And if so, they will have earned respect of Kohanim in addition to the natural respect that is due to them. Not only kavod, but also tiferes. So these are very profound words from the Malbim with regards to kavod and tiferes. And we move forward. Well, when I say forward, that means we'll actually stay here for a while, but consult a very interesting, well, ruling of the Rambam based on a curious aspect of the Bigdei Kahuna. Namely, that if you read the psukim, it's unavoidable, though the first time you notice it, it's a bit of a shock. The composition of some of the Bigdei Kahuna actually contains shatness, which is forbidden under other circumstances, but mandated within the Bigdei Kahuna. Specifically, the reference is to the avnate of the Kohen, which has the tcheles. The tcheles will always be wool, so will argaman, but then you have sheish, and sheish is linen, and they're spun together. That's a shatness garment. And on the one hand, so we look at that and we say, well, so be it. If the Torah says you have to wear it, you have to wear it. You can't refuse to wear the avnate on religious principle. I mean, the Torah says that that's what it's made of. And yet, there are ramifications. It should not be forgotten that the Bigdei Kahuna are made up of shatness. Because, and we speak of vigilance for the Kohanim, here's what the Rambam says. It is his final ruling in Hilchas Kilayim. Kohanim, shelov shu bigdei kahuna, shelo b'shas havoda. If a Kohen would be wearing bigdei kahuna, and he's not doing the avoda, afilu b'migdash, even if he's in the Beis HaMikdash, lokin, he's liable to Malkus. The timing is of the essence. As soon as he has finished the Avodah, he needs to remove the Avnate straight away. Mipnei ha'Avnate, shehu kil'ayim. The Avnate is Shatnis. V'lehutrubo ela b'shas Avodah. She mitzvah saseh. It's only mutter when he's doing the Avodah, so then we would say, aseh doch alo saseh. The positive mitzvah outweighs the negative. But as soon as he's finished the avoda, he has to take the avnit off straight away. So there is no room for pause. He has to remove the avnit as soon as he's finished the avoda. Now, interestingly, there's a comment of the Raivad. It's actually twofold, but we'll focus on the second. The Raivad, as we know, never shy in terms of voicing his opinion, if it differs from that of the Rambam. And here the Raivad says, "Umayde ka'amar mipnei ha'avnet." I'm puzzled by this Rambam. The Rambam says there could be a shatness problem in the Bigdei Kahuna, namely the belt, the avnet. Says the Raivad, "That's it. Any other Bigdei Kahuna? It seems that if you look through the parsha, you'll find others. Eino, not so. The otu." Choshen ve'efod milesbu kilayim? The choshen and the efod don't have kilayim? In other words, says the Raivad, if the Rambam is taking this approach, that if you're wearing kilayim, you've got to, as soon as the avodah is finished, you have to remove those sensitive items straight away. So why did he mention what is ultimately one of the three Bigdei Kahuna that have Shatnez? Not only does the belt have Shatnez, the Avnet, but also the Ephod and the Choshen have Shatnez as well. That's the question of the Raivat. Well, who will step in to defend and explain the Rambam? It is none other than the Rogatchover God, the Tzofnas Paneach. And the Rogatchover says a fundamental point. We may say it's a Lomdisha point. Namely, interestingly, it's clear from the Rambam that wearing the priestly garments is not a mitzvah. That's clear. Because if it was, then one wouldn't need to be doing the avodah in order to deal with the issue of shatnez. One wouldn't need to find that mitzvah of the avodah to push aside the mitzvah of shatnez. You're doing a mitzvah by wearing the garments. For point of reference, strictly speaking, when tcheles is in play, if a person has a linen garment and woolen tzitzis, which is shatnez, he can wear it. And it's a mitzvah, because we say, the positive mitzvah of wearing tzitzis pushes aside the negative prohibition against wearing shatnez. And that's it. You don't need to do anything when you're wearing tzitzis. The mitzvah is the wearing of the tzitzis. But the Rambam required that in order to push aside the mitzvah of shatnez in the Bigdei Kahuna, you need to be doing the avodah. That means apparently the wearing itself of Bigdei Kahuna is not a mitzvah. That's interesting. Says the Rogatchover, that is only true for a normal Kohen, what's known as a Kohen Hedyot. His four garments, wearing those four garments, are not a mitzvah. He needs them in order to perform the mitzvah of Avodah, but the wearing itself is not a mitzvah. But that's only true for a normal Kohen. But a Kohen Gadol, the very wearing of those garments is a mitzvah. It's like tzitzis. That's distinct. And should we ask, where do we see any such distinction? How do we know that for the Kohen Gadol, the very wearing is a mitzvah, and for the normal Kohen, it's not yet a mitzvah? Well, says Rav Kasher, the answer is right in front of us. Pasuk Beis, which we've referred to already. For it states, V'asisa bigdei kodesh la'aharon achicha, make special garments for Aaron, your brother, l'chavadu l'sifaris. And now, let's ask a question. We may not have noticed this before. Aaron is the only one for whom special garments are made? Not so. He has more than everyone else, but there are bigdei kodesh for all the Kohanim. Why does the pasuk single out Aaron? Well, says Rav Kasher, this is the source in the Torah what the Rogatchover is saying. All Kohanim have Bigdei Kodesh. But when the pasuk says that Aaron's garments are lechavod ulesefares, what it's saying is because they are lechavod ulesefares, that is already fulfilling a mitzvah just by wearing them. The mitzvah is giving kavod and tiferes in the way that ultimately, or in its own league, the Bigdei Kohen Gadol do more than the other begotten. That's why only Aaron is mentioned. The wearing itself is kavod and tiferes, but that's a mitzvah in itself. Whereas the other Kohanim, they are not performing a mitzvah in the wearing of their garments until they actually do the avodah itself. And what's fascinating to note, as soon as this distinction comes out, and it's a major distinction, because we normally put them all together. As far as we're concerned, the difference between a normal Kohen and a Kohen Gadol is arithmetic. 8 is more than 4. But the notion that something else is happening, there's a different dynamic, as he's wearing his 8 garments, as opposed to the 4 of the Kohen Hedyot, that's news. But Rabbi Avraham Gurewitz points out that it's borne out by a simple reading, again of the Pasuk later on, in the beginning of Parshas Kisisa, Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Yud, and this is a Pasuk which is repeated. The Torah lists the component parts of the Mishkan a few times. And one of those times is in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yud. And there it states, it begins as Big Day Hasrat, and then states, and we watch carefully the phraseology, Ves Big Day HaKodesh Le'Aaron HaKohen, the holy garments for Aaron, Ves Big Day Vanav Le'Chahen, to act as Kohanim. And that pasuk is repeated in the beginning of Parshas Vayakhel. That means that, once again, with regards to Aaron's garments, it says, Es bigdei hakodesh la'aron hakohen, the holy garments for Aaron, the person. If as soon as he's Aaron, that's all you need. Whereas bigdei vanav, the garments for his sons, are lechahein. That's a verb. That's a tafkid. That's a function. They need to do something. That's what the clothing are for. Because if they're not doing anything, they may have a problem actually wearing those garments. It's such a fine detection within the pasuk, but it's become white. That's the difference, and that's really the yisod of the Rosh Hashanah. And what's interesting to note, again, to further corroborate from another angle, one of the earliest codifiers of the 613 mitzvahs was Rav Sadia Gaon. And in his Sefer HaMitzvahs, curiously, he only codifies the Big Day Kohen Gadol as a separate mitzvah in Taryag. He makes no special mention of the garments of a normal Kohen, which is unusual because isn't the Pasuk talks about both. Okay, he has eight and they have four, but they're both mitzvahs, aren't they? But apparently, says Rav Gurewitz, what Rav Sadia Gaon is telling us is, no, they're not both mitzvahs, not in the same way. Because when you talk about a mitzvah of Taryag, you're talking about an independent mitzvah. The wearing of Aaron's, or the Kohen Gadol's, eight garments, that's an independent mitzvah. As soon as he wears them, he's fulfilling a mitzvah. But have we not seen that for a regular Kohen, wearing the garments is not yet a mitzvah? It only allows him to then, and enables him, and qualifies him to perform the mitzvah of Avodah. So for him, those four garments do not constitute a separate mitzvah of Taryag, because they're subsumed and they are a hechsher, as we would say, a qualifying act for the Avodah, which is the actual mitzvah. So if one reads between the lines of Rav Sadia Gaon, which many people don't do, one gets the corroboration for this idea. And therefore, coming back to the Raivad's problem with the Rambam, namely, to remind ourselves, the Rambam said that as soon as the Kohen finishes, the Avodah's got to take off the belt straight away, otherwise he could be Chayav Malkus. I mean, timing is of the essence. And the Raivad says, well, if that's an issue, why did the Rambam mention only one garment that has shatnez? Aren't there others? Isn't there the Ephod? Isn't there the Choshen? Why not mention them as well? They have the same issue. Says the Rogachover, based on our understanding of the Rambam, they do not have the same issue. Because it is only the belt of the regular Kohen, with the very wearing of which is not itself a mitzvah, but rather it has to be doing the Avodah to push aside the problem of Kilayim. That's why as soon as he finishes the Avodah, he has to take it off. Whereas those other two items mentioned by the Raivad, the Choshen and the Ephod, they're not worn by a normal Kohen. They're worn by the Kohen Gadol, and the Kohen Gadol has no such issue because he is constantly, by definition, performing a mitzvah by wearing them that pushes aside the lo sase. He'll never need to take them off, certainly not over this issue, and therefore the Rambam chose very specifically the one example which has the problem, namely the avnet. So this is a taste from the world of the Rogachover, an explanation of the Rambam's position. Now, I'd like to focus on a specific aspect or element within these garments, and that is the stones of the Choshen. As we know, they have a great deal said about them, and there's the 12 stones, and each one had the name of one of the Shvatim engraved upon it, and that's referred to in Perek Kaf Ches, Pasuk Kaf Aleph. Perek Kafches Pasuk Kaf Aleph states, V'ha'avanim tihyena al shmos b'nei Yisrael. The stones will have 12 names. Shteimisrei al shmosam. 12 on the names. And as we know, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, the way that it goes, Ketoldosam. Interestingly, the phraseology of the pasuk catches the attention of certain Mephorshim. It seems to be slightly, not the way we would have explained. We would translate that each of the stones has one of the names on it. Again, but if the words of the pasuk are v'ha'avanim tihyena al shmos b'nei Yisrael, which if we translate literally means that the stones will be on the names of the Jewish people, of B'nai Yisrael, the sons of Yisrael, of the tribes. That's actually not really what happens. The stones are not on the names are on the stones. Could the Pasuk perhaps have said, V'shemos B'nai Yisrael, Yihiyu, Alavanim, Shtei Misri? So are the names on the stones or on the stones on the names? It's an interesting shaila. We kind of understand that it means that the names are engraved on the stones, but the pasuk didn't really say that. And it could have, because it has all the words. It just rearranged them, or arranged them differently. Also, interestingly, as we know, these names were not written with ink, but rather they were engraved. And that the pasuk indicates when it says, further in this pasuk, Kaf Aleph, Pituchei Chosam Ish Al Shemo. Pituchei Chosam, in the way that it's like a seal. Just as when one prepares a seal, so one does so by engraving within the seal, and then when you impress it, the letters will come out. So too, the way that the name shall be written onto the stones is like that, engraved, like a seal, like a Chosam. Although, interestingly again, the comparison doesn't seem to be entirely parallel, because it happens to be, if you've ever looked at a seal, the way that the letters are engraved is that they're backwards, which you need, because it's the nature of a seal that it's written backwards, but when you impress it then on the paper, it will come out forwards. Now, nothing's being impressed anywhere here, which means that it seems to be something of a partial comparison. In other words, it's like a seal in the sense that it's engraved as opposed to written, but it's obviously written in order from right to left, and the letters are facing the right way, not backwards. So it's something of a partial comparison. Okay, so be it. That is the, shall we say, the simple approach to this pasuk. Until came along the Gaon Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin and explained that actually, no. The engraving on the stones is backwards. The comparison to a chosam, to a seal, is complete. And surely, as when you engrave on a seal, you'd engrave everything backwards, so too, the names are engraved here, pituchei chosam. Except, why? Why do we want the writing to be backwards? Well, says Maral Diskin, go back to the beginning of the pasuk, which stated, V'ha'avanim tihiyena ashmos b'nei Yisrael, which literally translated means the stones will be on the names of the sons of Yisrael. Now, we of course had a problem with that, because the stones aren't on the names are on the stones, except the pasuk doesn't say that. But rather what it means is, the difference between those two is that we are of the understanding, the presumption, that you have the stones and they're set into the Choshen, and on the outside of the stones you engrave Reuven, Shimon, Levi, etc. Says Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin, but the Pasuk is saying no. The engraving of the names doesn't take place on the outside of the stones. It takes place on the inside of the stone, on the base of the stone. That is to say, before the stone is put into the Choshen, the name is engraved, and then it is the side with the engraving that is placed in to the Choshen. And that's why the stone is actually on the name. because the name is in, and the stone rests on it. How can you read the stone if it's on the inside? Because the stones were translucent, and therefore the name shone through. Very nice. That means that the pasuk is kipshuto, the stones are on the names. There's just one problem. If the stone is on the name, if you write something and then you turn it around and put it in, it's going to read backwards because you're no longer facing it. When you write it, you're facing it, but if you then you turn it around, the whole thing reads backwards. That's not okay, is it? Says Meryl Diskin, no, it's not okay, and that's the very reason why it was originally written backwards. It was originally engraved backwards, because if you engrave it backwards and then you turn around to put it in, it will read Keseder. So it's a stunning perush. And this perush of the Meryl Diskin is quoted by Tzvi Pesach Frank. He said he heard it from him directly. And it's unbelievable. Because essentially it is taking two questions that each one by itself we could perhaps have not really paid that much attention to. Because you don't know what to do with them. Until you take them both together and then they tell you everything to know. And this is the understanding of the Meryl Diskin, which is Mamashe stunning. The stones of the Choshen, as we know from Chazal, had high prices attached to them. I submit that this Perush of the Rebbe Shmuel Leib Diskin, no price can be attached to it. And what's very interesting is that Tzvi Pesach Frank, within the course of his halachic writings at Shelis and Shuvas, he says that perhaps there could be halachic ramifications from this explanation of Rebbe Shmuel Leib Diskin. How so? One of the 39 melachos of Shabbos is, of course, kosev, writing. Now, as we know, many of the halachos, well, the halachos themselves, the melachos of Shabbos, come from the Mishkan, and one of the primary concepts within the melachos of Shabbos is that if you do the melacha with a shinui, in a way that comes out unusual or in an unusual manner, so that's still forbidden on a drabbanon level to protect the melacha, but it's not meleches machsheves in that way, if the result doesn't really come out so good or... Which means, says Tzvi Pesach Frank, if a person writes words, that's kosev. That's the malach of kosev. What if he writes backwards on Shabbos? Now it seems clear to me, says Meryl Diskin, says Tzvi Pesach Frank in the Tshuvas Har Tzvi, that if you take a piece of paper and ink, you write backwards, so then you're potter. You're probably potter from all mitzvahs, because why are you writing backwards? But it doesn't matter. In any case, in terms of the malach of Shabbos, that would not be a malach. However, sometimes people do write backwards, because what if a person is writing on a pane of glass? What if he wants to make an announcement to the customers outside of his store or passing by? So if you write forwards, they're going to read backwards in the street. The way that you want the all goods, half price, closing down, final clearance, you have to write that backwards on the inside in order for them to read it in the correct order. What then would be the status of such a person if he did this on Shabbos? And to actually break down the question, Rav Frank says, in terms of his action, it's unusual. But in terms of the result, it's a better result than if he wrote, because if you write forwards, they'll read backwards. Write backwards, they'll read forwards. So that's an interesting question to ponder, but especially when we remember that so much, if not all, in principle, of what we know about Hilchos Shabbos comes from the Mishkan. And according to Rabbi Shmuel Leib Diskin, this is exactly what was done in the Mishkan. They wrote backwards in order to be read forwards. And according to some, the Avnei Nezer of Sokachov, the Malacha of Kosev is learned perhaps from the writing on the stones, the writing of those names on the stones, Avnei Choshen, Avnei Eifod. This would seem to be a source that there would be a full chiyuv for writing like that. It is an exact application of the way that they wrote in the Mishkan, writing backwards to be read forward. So it's a fascinating discussion generated by that perush of Rabbi Shmuel Leib Diskin. Let us conclude by going to the end of the parsha. And the final section deals with, and that's in Perek Lamed, deals with the Mizbeach HaKetoros. And That's really the final verses here. And it describes where it is, where it should be placed, and what it's made of, and it's there for the Keturahs. This is what's known as the Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden Mizbeach, because it is cedar wood, but it's plated with gold in the Mishkan, as opposed to the Mizbeach for Korbanos, which was, again, wood, but plated with copper, known as Mizbeach HaNechoshes, which was in the courtyard of the Mishkan. Okay. All Mefarshim are wondering, beginning with Rishonim, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, Sforno, and others, what is the mitzvah of making this Mizbeach for Ketores doing at the end of our Parsha? We mentioned at the beginning that the divide generally, it's almost entirely true between Truma last week and Tetzaveh this week, is that Truma is about the Mishkan and its appurtenances, and Tetzaveh is about Bigdei Kehuna, the priestly garments. This is not a priestly garment. This is one of the Klei HaMikdash, Klei HaMishkan. What then is it doing in the end of Tetzaveh, and not somewhere at least in Parshas Truma? That is the basic question that Rishonim deal with. There is a fascinating answer, a halachic answer, which is given to this question by the Meshech Chochma, and as we will see, he was preceded by someone before that, someone whose writings presumably did not have access to, which is often the case. But the Meshech Chochma explains as follows. The rule with regard to the Klei HaMikdash is, every Kli has its mitzvah. Menorah has lighting, the Aron contains the Luchos, the Shulchan has Lechem Aponim, the Mizbeach has Korbanos. The rule with regards to all of those Kalim is, if for some reason you do not have that Kli available or present, that it is impossible to do the mitzvah. The presence or the existence of that Kli is non-negotiable. It's critical to the performance of that mitzvah. If there's no Shulchan for whatever reason, there can be no Lechem Aponim. There's no menorah, there can be no hadlakas haner. That's true with regards to all of the kelim. And yet, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Zevachim, in Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis, that this is not the case for the golden mizbeach, for the mizbeach haketores. The Gemara states, mizbeach shenekar, if for some reason that mizbeach went missing from where it's meant to be, Maktirin b'makoma. You can offer the Ketores where it normally is, even if the Mizbeach isn't there. It is the exception amongst the Klei HaMikdash that its presence is not critical to the mitzvah that's performed. The Gemara doesn't say why, but that's the halacha. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, it seems to me that would explain why this Kli is really mentioned after everything. Really, because all the items mentioned so far, whether they are the Klei HaMikdash or the Bigdei Kehuna, are critical to the performance of the Avodah. And the final item that's mentioned, and it is saved for last, because there's a mitzvah, but it's the only one where if you didn't have it, you'd still perform the mitzvah. That's what put it at the end of Tetzaveh. So says the Meshech Chochma. And what's fascinating, I discovered this week, is Meshech Chochma was mechavin to one of the gedolim of 200 years before his time, one of the gedola Yerushalayim, the Sephardi gedolim, in the 1600s, Rabbi Moshe Jalanty. And he's quoted by his son-in-law, Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, and Rabbi Jalanty raises the same question. Everyone's wondering, what is the Mizbeach for Keturahs doing at the end of Tetzaveh? And it seems to me, says Rav Jalanty, I looked around, I didn't find an answer that helped me, but it seems to me that it is because of this Gemara, and he quotes the same Gemara that in 200 years time Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk will quote, that it's based on that Gemara in Zvachim, that if the Mizbeach was moved somehow, the mitzvah still stands. Almost exactly identical to what the Meshech Chochma will say, but interestingly, slightly different orientation, in the sense that, says Rav Moshe Jalanty, it could be that in order to indicate that the mitzvah still exists if the Mizbeach moved, so that's why the Torah moved it. In other words, which is a fascinating idea in terms of Parshanut, because really Reb Moshe Jalanty is equating, shall we say, scriptural relocation with geographical relocation. As surely as the Torah took it out of the Mishkan and presented it elsewhere, is to teach you that for some reason it actually does come to leave the Mishkan, the mitzvah is still there, which is truly fascinating. But a second approach, closer to our time, from the great Rav Leib Hyman Zatzal, the Rav of the Groshul in Beit Bagan, who was always has something unique to say. We're mindful, of course, that in the Parsha Tetzav, it's famous for the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu's name from the time that he was born is not mentioned there. And many Mefarshim talk about it. There's the 101 Psukim, and there's no reference to Moshe. Not by name. And what are we to make of this? It seems to me, says Rav Hyman, that it is appropriate that Moshe's name should not be mentioned in Tetzaveh. It's interesting that actually a way to begin here, or to approach what he's about to say, is that Aaron's name is not mentioned in Parshas Truma. That's also interesting, because we know from the outset that everything in Truma is really principally in the domain of the Kohanim, represented by Aaron. But you go through all of Truma and there's no reference to Aaron. And then when you start with Tetzaveh, then it becomes about Aaron Achicha. In a sense, one may say that Parshas Tetzaveh is Aaron's Parsha. I mean, it's about him, and it's about the chosenness of Aaron. Yet, as we know, Aaron was not the original choice for Kahuna. It was Moshe. Moshe argued too much. That's what the Gemara in Shabbos says in Daf Tzadik Zayin. Moshe argued too much at the burning bush, and the Kahuna was taken away from him. It says Vayicha Af Hashem. He says Hello Aaron Achicha HaLevi, means that he was meant to be the Levi and you the Kohen, but now he'll be the Kohen and you will be the Levi. So Moshe, the Kahuna was removed from Moshe, and therefore, as the kahuna is given to Aaron, which it really is in Parshat Tetzaveh, it is appropriate that Moshe's name is not mentioned, because that's part of the removal of the kahuna, a complete transfer from in the parsha which introduces Aaron as the Kohen. There's no mention of Moshe, and this has perhaps implications for the Mizbeach HaKetores. You see, the Mizbeach HaKetores, the Mizbeach for the incense, in principle, it's like all the other kelim of the Mishkan, the Aron and the Menorah and the Shulchan. Yes, in principle, and halachically also. But in essence, there's something unique about it. As we know, certain of the kelim had crowns. Zer, what's called. Three of the kelim specifically. The Aron has a crown, the Shulchan, and this Mizbeach HaKetores. And Rashi actually tells us that in Parshas Truma, that these three crowns correspond to the three crowns that we speak about in Pirkei Avos. Shlosha Ksarim Hei, Keser Torah, Keser Kahuna, and Keser Malchus. How do they correspond? Well, the Aron, of course, with the Torah, represents Keser Torah. The Shulchan, says Rashi, represents Keser Malchus, Shulchan Malachim, an abundance of well-being, prosperity. And then the Mizbeach HaKetores, the crown around there, is Keser Kahuna. So that's very interesting, because whereas in principle and on a basic level, all the Kalim are in the domain of the Kohanim, but the one that really is about Kahuna is the Mizbeach HaKetores. And therefore, how appropriate it is that the Kli of the Mishkan, which is specifically and uniquely connected to the Kahuna, should be in Tetzaveh and not in Truma, because Tetzaveh is really when the concept of Kahuna is developed. Aaron makes his first mention, Moshe's name is not mentioned at all, and therefore of all of the Kalim, the Kahuna Dika Kli of the Mizbeach HaKetores actually is in Parshas Tetzaveh. But after all that, the Rav Hyman concludes with a very beautiful thought, and that is, it's really the counter thought to what we normally focus on. Moshe lost the Kahuna, he did. But do we know how Moshe feels about it? Moshe is involved, actually, in preparing Aaron for Kahuna. and in anointing Aaron for a kahuna and making the cloak, make sure that everything's ready for him. And if Moshe doesn't do it, l'shem shamayim, it doesn't work, because it's got to be l'cha hanoli, it's got to be l'shma. And therefore, this is the very beautiful sub-theme that's happening within Tetzaveh. It's not Moshe's parsha. He's not even mentioned by name. But without him, Aaron can't become the Kohen. And without Moshe making him a Kohen with a full heart, he's not going to become a Kohen. It's going to be felt in the kahuna. And it's interesting, because we always remember Aaron really was meant to be the leader of the Jewish people. He was certainly the people's choice. That was the expectation. He was a Navi before Moshe, and the people knew him. And Hashem decided otherwise, and it's Moshe. How does Aaron feel? The Ra'acha V'samach B'Livah. He's happy for Moshe. So Moshe took really Aaron's place, and Aaron's happy for Moshe. In Kehuna, Aaron took Moshe's place, and Moshe's happy for Aaron. And that's Sheva Sechim Gam Yachad. That's certainly a lesson worth dwelling upon from these parshas. We'll leave it over there for the